Funeral. I punched him. Can you believe that? Me, Lorelei Bird. I punched a 6-foot man clean on his jaw. Hurt me more than it hurt him, I'd wager. But it made me feel good. I think it changed me forever, that punch. But yes, there it was. All the way through my childhood. First the stillborn girl, then the rape, and all the silence and all the secrecy. The atmosphere always there, like a sinister fog. The resentment. My father clearly believed it had something to do with my mother, that she'd brought it on herself in some way. He used to talk to her as if he hated her. And the focus on the self that such a psychological injury can incur. My mother was always gazing at her own navel, to the detriment of her daughters. Awful. Awful. So I leapt on the first undamaged man to cross my path and made him fill me up with babies so that I could do it my way. And hey, what do you know? My way has ended up full of secrets and silence, too. Different silence. Different secrets. But still, it's all there. The things we cannot talk about. And I can see now how it's poisoned everything. It's all such a terrible shame. But well, hopefully the rot will stop with Megan. She's such a super mother and wife. Really. I know I moan about her and her obsession with cleanliness and order, but really she is doing an amazing job. She's so grounded, and I have no idea how or why. Her children adore her, and they adore each other. And as for her husband, if she can forgive him, then so can I. He worships the ground she walks on. So, yes, hopefully. There it is. The end of the cycle. For them, at least. So there you go, gorgeous Jim. Another chunk of me for you to play about with. Can you fix me? Could you? Please? I dream about your belt buckle, Jim. I dream about unclasping it. Kiss, 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 kiss. Monday, 14th of February, 2011. Happy Valentine's, darling Jim. Not that I'm a fan of Valentine's, really. I always thought that every day should be Valentine's. Well, potentially Valentine's, at least, if you see what I mean. You know, why wait for a certain day if you want to buy flowers now? Unimaginative, really, isn't it? Buying overpriced roses on the same day as everybody else. You know, you see a woman walking home with a bouquet of flowers, you think, wow, someone really loves her. You see the same woman with the same bouquet on Valentine's, and you just get the feeling that someone was going through the motions. But anyway, that's just me. Good luck to the rest of the world. And out of special consideration to my feelings on the subject, I declare this email a romance-free zone. So instead, I shall regale you with the fact that I have spent the last 24 hours on the toilet. Sorry. Probably TMI, as they say. But there you go. Something I ate, probably. Or maybe a bug I picked up from the swimming baths last time I went. Either way, yuck. Horrible. And it's times like this that I miss living with another human. Do you feel like that, Jim? So many advantages to living solo, until you've got a dire case of the squits. And you just want someone there so you can say, poor me, aren't I a poor, poor thing? And have someone stroke your back and say, yes, yes, you are a poor, poor thing, and make you drink fluids and give you things to help. Ah, well, choices made, paths chosen, etc. No word from Rory since his last email. I've written a few times, but he still doesn't have a proper email account set up. so I suppose I'll just have to be patient. I spoke to Meg at the weekend. They're planning a skiing trip for the Easter holidays, apparently. Skiing. Oh, can't imagine anything worse. God gives you a pair of perfectly good feet, and then you go and stick some big long bits of metal on them and throw yourself down the side of a mountain. No, thank you. And it costs a fortune. I try not to get too cross when I think of all those thousands of pounds spent in a fortnight that would last me all year, probably. But Meg won't give me any money. Says she'd like to, but she's convinced I'd spend it all on tat. And she's probably right. Oh, God. What an absolute pain in the arse I am. Well, on that note, I will leave you. I sincerely hope you're not out on the razz tonight at a table for two with some lovely young thing clutching a bouquet. Oh, the very thought of it makes my blood boil and bubble. And, well, rest assured that I am here, close to a toilet, my thoughts with you, my heart with you, my everything with you, tonight and every night. My love. Kiss, 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 kiss. Tuesday, 15th of February, 2011. Oh, I am still not well, darling Jim. I have been pretty much glued to the toilet for the last 48 hours. I feel very weak with it. I'm making myself eat, although I have no appetite whatsoever, but it's all just coming clean through me moments later. I suppose if it's still like this by this time tomorrow, I should make an appointment to see my GP. Yuck. I hate my GP. Big, loud woman with meaty fingers. She's very patronising. She calls me dear. As if I was an old lady. For God's sake. I can't bear her. And the thought of her putting those big, meaty fingers of hers anywhere near my back passage. Oh, good grief, Jim. I think I'd throw up. So keep your fingers crossed for me that this all blows over very soon, and I am spared that particular humiliation. But I have an announcement to make. Jim, I have decided I am going to work on getting out of the house. I mean, properly, so that I can spend the night with you. I truly believe that all this is helping. You know, all this talking, all this analysing. I truly believe that. I was speaking to Madeline yesterday. She's Vicky's eldest. She's 20. Delightful girl. We went through a rough time together when she lived here. My fault. Totally and utterly my fault. But we've made a kind of friendship now. She lives with her boyfriend just outside Cheltenham, and I was telling her about you, about our chats, about your problems and my problems, and she said I should try a night at hers. Soon. You know, she's only 3/4 of an hour away. If it was a total disaster, I could always drive home. Obviously, I'm making this sound 1,000 times more straightforward than it was, when actually, had you been there, you'd have seen me shaking uncontrollably in a coffee shop, halfway to a panic attack at the mere thought. I had to go outside for air. Daft cow. Still, it's a start. It is something to focus on. I hope that makes you happy, Jim. I do so want you to be happy. But in the meantime, we must keep talking. We must keep this open, this incredible, life-changing connection we've made to each other. It's becoming like oxygen to me, Jim. It really is. I need it more and more every day. You are making me stronger. I love you so much, more than I've ever loved anyone. Oh, here we go again. The toilet beckons. More and on, beautiful man of mine. Kiss, 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 kiss. April 2011. The following morning, all four of them strapped themselves into Megan's people carrier and headed to the funeral parlour where Lorelei's body had been sent from the coroner's office. Megan had had a call the previous evening, while they ate in the pub in the next village along. Too many curious gazes and awkward reunions in the local. "Your mother is ready," said an earnest young man called Samuel Moss. "We've made her look very nice. I think you'll be pleased." Megan could not begin to imagine. She had never seen a body laid out for a funeral before. "Thank you very much," she said. "We'll see you in the morning." They'd laid her out on a bed in a tiny room in the back corner of the parlour. She was surrounded by silk flowers and attended by the boy called Samuel Moss, who was dressed in a suit, his thin hair greased down like a pensioner's, and so theatrically respectful he was bordering on a character from The Fast Show. "I'll leave you all to treasure your time with Lorelei, if I may call her that." Megan and Beth looked at each other and exchanged pained looks, their cheeks sucked in with repressed laughter. "Yes," Megan managed, "you may. Thank you." The laughter dissipated as Samuel left the room, and they moved in closer to their mother's body. "She's so thin," Bethan cried out in a loud whisper. 6'8", said Megan. "God! But she looks sweet, doesn't she?" Bethan put her hand against Lorelei's hand and nodded. "So little."
"Like a child," said Colin, laying his hand against her cheek.
"What the hell is she wearing?" said Bethan.
"Christ knows."
Megan turned to check that Samuel wasn't listening at the door.
"It's revolting.
It looks like something an old lady would wear." It was a pale blue dress, devoid of any of Lorelei's precious colours. It sat loose around her handspan waist and ended just an inch too low below her knees. It had a row of three buttons on a placket down the front, and long sleeves.
"We should have brought her something," said Bethan.
Megan sighed. "They asked me to. I tried to find something, but honestly, as ridiculous as it might sound, I couldn't find any of her nice clothes. I have no idea where she kept them." "We'll have to buy her something," she said decisively. "From that boutique. We'll buy her something colourful. Bring it over later."
"Oh," said Colin, "surely that's a waste of money. She's only..."
"No," Beth interjected. "Meg's right. We'll buy her something lovely." Colin nodded and smiled, happy to be outnumbered. "She looks pretty," said Molly. Megan smiled and put her arm around her daughter's waist. "She does, doesn't she?" She didn't want to say that she thought her mother looked like an awful shrunken-down witch, her unkempt hair tamed into a long grey plait, her skin the colour of cement. She had to remind herself of what her mother must have looked like before they'd worked their magic on her. This woman who'd starved herself to death and been found dead in her car on the side of the road, with her insides eaten away by disease. She should be grateful for small mercies. They spent another half an hour in the room with Lorelei. Nobody cried. Not even Bethan, with her body pumped full of hormones. But it was sweet and tender nonetheless. The three women left Colin to talk about arrangements for the funeral with the director and drove into the village. They parked outside the funny boutique that had been there for always. Their mother had brought them here when they were young, left them to roam about the trailing jungle of clothes rails while she tried on brightly coloured dresses, and an ingratiating woman called Grace said things like, "Oh, Laurie, that's the one. It really sets off your amazing figure. Not many people round here could get away with something like that. You're a natural clothes horse." The boutique had changed with the times, and Grace, with her plume of silver hair and chunky paste jewellery, was nowhere to be seen. Just a bored, beautiful young girl, who looked as though she was home from boarding school for the holidays, perched on a stool behind the till. The dress they chose, at £219, was ludicrously expensive, but it had been reduced from £395, owing, Megan assumed, to the fact that it was in such an unfeasibly small size. A tiny size 6 scrap of silk chiffon printed all over with peacock feathers in gemstone colours.
On the way back to the funeral parlour, they dropped Lorelei's laptop into a repair shop. "This laptop belonged to our mother," she said to the jolly-looking middle-aged couple behind the counter. "She just passed away." They expressed their condolences in lush Cotswold burrs. "We need to access her laptop. We don't have a password. Is there... do you..." The couple looked doubtful, but keen to help. They mentioned a nephew who lived in the next village. He might know someone. They said to leave it with them and tore off a deposit slip from a small pad underneath their desk. At no point did they suggest or imply that there was anything untoward about this request, and Megan smiled as she tried to imagine the equivalent reaction in the laptop repair shop at the top of her road in Tufnell Park. The police would have been involved in moments, she suspected. They took the dress to the funeral parlour and collected Colin, and then Megan drove them all back to the birdhouse. It was around 11 a.m. as they pulled up on the curb outside the house. The skipmen had been and gone. Two empty containers sat on the road. The sun shone on. The day stretched ahead. They turned the corner onto the garden path, talking loudly about plans for Lorelei's funeral, laughing about Samuel Moss's precocious obsequiousness, joking about how he probably met his friends in the pub after work in a hoodie, talking like a South London gangster. And then Megan stopped and stared. Her eyes widened and her jaw dropped, and she looked at the wiry, blonde-haired, leather-skinned man on the doorstep and whispered, "Rory." Chapter 14. Sunday, 27th of February, 2011.
"I'm coming, Jim. I really am. I spent the night at Madeline's. The whole night. Well, to be accurate, I arrived at 10 p.m. and left in the pitch black before she'd woken up, but I did manage a couple of hours' sleep. I'm not saying that it was easy. It was, to be horribly honest, a bit of a nightmare. But God, Jim, it's a start. What is it the psychiatrists say? Baby steps? Yes, baby steps. And I shall do it again. I promise you that. Baby steps towards you, Jim, and your body, and all the wonderful things we will do together in the blissful dark of night. Christ, I am yearning for you. For it. I truly am. Kiss, 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 kiss." Tuesday, 1st of March, 2011. "Darling, thank you. You are so encouraging and strong for me. I honestly feel like I could do anything for you. I am truly starting to believe I might change." Imagine that. "I put my car in to be serviced today, Jim. If I'm to drive it all the way to you, the last thing I need is a blown tire, or a gasket, or whatever all those other bits and pieces of cars are called. Wouldn't that be tragic? To overcome these wretched demons of mine and then be scuppered at the last fence by a flat tire. So, I am selling a ring of mine to pay for it and having it done. Luckily, the mechanics is the wrong direction from the shops, so hopefully I won't be tempted to go and spend the money before I pay for the repairs. And if I am tempted, I will just think of you, Jim, standing tall and handsome in your doorway. I will think of me stepping into your big, strong arms, taking your hand and following you to your bed. And that will be enough for me. That is all I want now. Kiss, 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 kiss." Wednesday, 2nd of March, 2011. "No, Jim, I do not want a penny of your money. You are a beautiful, wonderful man, but you are as financially constrained as I am, and there is no reason why you should have to pay towards my old banger. Cook me a lovely meal upon my arrival instead. Well, I was going to have another dry run at Madeline's house last night, but I seem to have caught a nasty cold. I'm very phlegmy and hacky. Keep getting terrible coughing fits. Really, it's just one thing after another. I blame the public baths. I really do. I might stop going. They never look quite clean in there. Black mould and all that. Horrible. So, I will wait until I have shaken this cough, and then make another plan with Maddie. Are you bored of waiting for me yet, Jim? Are you fed up with endless words and no action? I am doing all I can. I truly am. I am changing for you, Jim. Slowly but surely. Kiss, 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 kiss.
April 2011. Rory had no words at first. He'd forgotten how to talk to his family. He'd more or less forgotten how to talk, full stop.
He'd spent 6 weeks at a Buddhist retreat. 23 hours a day of silent prayer and contemplation amongst whitewashed walls and shaved heads. No music. No television. No traffic. Just cicadas and chanting. He did not want to be in this country. He did not want to be looking at these staring, gawping faces, at the tear-sodden cheeks of his father, at the confusion and curiosity of his sisters. But he'd had a moment of deep understanding halfway through the retreat. He'd come to understand that everything was his fault. Rhys had killed himself because of him, because he was such a bad brother to him. Kaylee had been forced into the arms of her father by him, by his abandonment of her and their child. That union had brought about the events at Vicky's funeral that Megan had told him about in a badly punctuated email shortly afterwards. And now his mother was dead because he had not come home to look after her once he'd been released from jail. He should have been here. And he wasn't. And now she was gone. All his fault. All of it. They all looked so old. His father looked ancient. His sisters were no longer girls. They looked meaty and matured. His younger sister was pregnant. He could not remember how old she was. He could barely remember how old he was. They looked fat. They weren't fat, but they looked fat. Compared to himself. Compared to the people he'd eaten rice and broth with 3 times a day for 6 weeks. Compared to the peasants and farmers who worked the land around them in 100 degrees. And this house, his mother's house, the house where he grew up, where he lost his brother and then lost himself, it was everything that the retreat had not been. He had walked the perimeter of the house again and again, waiting for someone to find him here. He had peered in through the windows, through the glass in the doors, seen the piles and the boxes, all the things, all the stuff. He thought how, as a child, he'd laughed affectionately at his mother's ways. He remembered the trips to Pound Stretcher and the cash and carry, the endless amounts of stuff coming into the house, the endless sums of money being spent, the endless, filthy accumulation. How could he have thought it was funny? How could he have thought it was cute? It was obscene. What his mother had done here, as poor people scavenged for food in landfill, as parents watched their children die, as disease wiped out villages and waterholes dried up, it subverted everything. It was grotesque. His sisters, with their mascaraed lashes and daft shoes, his niece, he assumed she was a niece, with her big nest of blonde hair, her neon fingernails and spoiled demeanour. They looked alien to him, as alien as if they had green skin and tentacles. But he needed to get over that. He needed to shut his mind to its complaints and outrage. Here he was, what remained of him, and he had a job to do. He smiled
and he got to his feet and said, "All right." Colin brought Rory a box, like the one he'd brought for the two girls. But Rory shook his head and said, "No, thanks. I don't want any stuff."
"You might be sorry," said Colin, "if you don't. One day you might wish you'd kept something, and it'll be too late."
Rory shook his head again and said, "No, I won't. I don't know much about me, but I know that much. And besides, I'd have nowhere to put it."
"I can keep it for you," said Megan, "until you're settled."
Rory smiled and shook his head.
"Nah," he said. "Honest, I don't want it."
"Where are you going to stay?" asked Megan.
"Here," he said, looking from Megan to his father and back again. "If there's room."
His father took him upstairs to show him Reese's room, with talk of finding a mattress.
"I can sleep on the floor," he said. "I've been on the floor for the past 6 years. I've got kind of used to it."
The three girls turned to each other after Rory and Colin had gone.
"He looks really sad," said Beth.
"He looks terrible," said Megan.
"I think he's kind of cool," said Molly.
Rory's presence galvanized them. By the end of that day, they'd come almost to the back of the kitchen. They cleared the hoard all the way to the kitchen windows so that the sunlight finally had a way through and the sudden burst of daylight really spurred them on. Molly and Rory worked together as a team, being the youngest and the thinnest. Megan appraised them from a distance. They looked like father and daughter, with their golden hair, their lean bodies and fine features. They talked a lot, and there was a lot of mutual laughter. In the presence of a grown man, who she for some reason saw as being her peer, Molly reverted to some of her old teenagery habits, talking to Meg as if she was slightly subnormal. Megan couldn't catch half of what they were saying, but it was clear that Rory felt more comfortable with his niece than he did with his sisters and his father. Molly didn't know him. She wasn't a threat. There was also a sense that he aligned himself more closely with a teenager than with people of his own age, as if he was Peter Pan. And, of course, Megan pondered, he hadn't come close to growing up, had he? From home to commune, from commune to drug dealer's lackey, from lackey to prison and from prison to a retreat. All his many experiences had been so one-dimensional, so cosseted. He'd never had to take responsibility for himself. As they ran out of light, a rainstorm threatened overhead, so they packed themselves into the people carrier and headed for the pub. It was one of the few locals that hadn't been turned into a gastropub, that still had patterned carpets and laminated menus.
"I used to come here all the time," said Rory, taking it all in, his hands stuffed into the pockets of one of his dad's fleecy jackets. "This was where me and my mates used to do all our underage drinking." The landlord turned a blind eye. He shrugged.
Colin went to buy them drinks at the bar, and they shuffled themselves into a booth by the open back door. Rory was talking about the mates he'd left behind, wondering what happened to so-and-so and what's-his-name, remembering terrible tales of multicoloured vomit and setting fire to bins. Molly was staring at him adoringly. The rain was coming down now outside the door in weighty sheets, rumbles of thunder on the far horizon. Colin returned with a metal tray and offloaded the round. Red wine for Megan and himself, J2O for Molly, fizzy water for Rory and Beth. And there they sat. Colin, Megan, Bethan, Rory, and Molly. In the pub, having a drink together. Megan sucked it in. She felt an odd nostalgia. Odd, because this had never happened before. She had never sat in a pub with her family before. But she liked it. Very much.
"What are your plans?" she asked Rory.
He grimaced.
"I want to make amends," he said.
"What?" She'd been expecting a more prosaic response.
I want to make amends. I want to make up for it all. For all the mess I made. I want to clear out Mum's house and make it beautiful again. I want to grow up.
Everyone nodded, but it was clear that nobody really understood what he was saying.
How's Tia? He said to Colin, and the shock of the words sent invisible ripples across the table.
Oh, said Colin, flushing slightly. She's great. Really, really great.
Would she like to meet me, do you think?
Megan gulped. My God. Rory had never been one to say what was on his mind. He'd never, as far as she was aware, actually had anything on his mind. And now here he was, up front and saying it plain.
My goodness, well, yes, said Colin. Yes, she would. I know she would. I've only ever said good things about you. Both of us have...
Rory nodded staunchly.
That's good, he said. Maybe she'll come for the funeral.
Yes, said Colin. I expect she will. Especially if she knows you'll be here.
Rory nodded again. Then he put down his water, looked around and said,
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for everything. If it hadn't been for me, everything might have been so different.
Beth and Megan both said, What? At the same time.
I was so self-centred, he said. When we started big school, I just abandoned Reese. Left him to get on with it. He used to sit outside my bedroom door sometimes, just listening to me. I know he was there, and I never asked him in. Never asked him out with my mates. I never let him into my life. It was like I dumped him, you know. Like he was a girlfriend I'd had enough of.
He let his shoulders slump, and he sighed.
He killed himself because of me. And it's time to stop running away from that fact and to start dealing with it.
He shrugged.
So here I am. Cheers.
He raised his glass of water, and everyone else raised their drinks, and it was the strangest toast that Megan had ever heard in her life.
It wasn't your fault, she said, more to normalise the situation than because she knew it to be true.
Yeah, he said simply. It was.
Megan and Bethan looked at each other.
I've had plenty of time to think about this, he continued, and I know I'm right.
It's my fault, said Colin, in a tone of voice that suggested the unburdening of a great weight.
No, said Bethan, her voice catching. It's mine.
A crack of lightning lit the bruised sky. Another roll of thunder followed suit. It was none of us, said Megan, looking at her family. It was all of us.
Chapter 15. Saturday, 12th of March, 2011.
Oh, Jim, I cannot shake this blasted cough. Honestly, I feel like an old woman, like I've aged a decade in a few weeks. Doesn't help that I'm losing all this weight. It's a vicious cycle. I'm too weak to eat, and then I get weaker because I haven't eaten. I have, you'll be thrilled to hear, made an appointment at the GP's. I can just about bear the thought of that woman's hands on my esophagus. Just about. In the meantime, Project Go and See Jim has ground to a halt. And to be frank, right now, Jim, sex is about the furthest thing from my mind, and it's not often I can say that. So, I've been thinking about Reese again. I've thought more about Reese in the past few months than I have in the past two decades. It's like he's back in this house sometimes. You know how you have a memory of something and it's flat, you know, like a piece of paper. It's just a fact that you can recall. A moment. And then other times, that memory extrapolates itself into something three-dimensional, with smells and textures and colour, and you think to yourself, where was that hiding all this time?
Do you ever get that, Jim?
Well, as you know, that's why I keep so many things. Because of that innate energy that things carry. That shadow of a memory that each thing casts. And the other day I went into Reese's room. Did I tell you that I kept it as he left it? Completely uncluttered. Isn't that odd? Maybe you could find a theory for that. You're so good at theorizing, Jim. And I walked in, and it was as though he was there. In the room. And I've never felt that before. Not once in all these years. And I'm a pretty spiritual person, as you know, Jim. So it's odd that I've never felt it. But I realized it wasn't a ghost. It was his spirit. And then I realized that a spirit is just another word for a memory, isn't it? The stronger the memory, the stronger the spirit. Because as much as I'd love to believe that the spirit lives on as a thing separate to humanity, I know that's not true. It's in our minds, in our hearts, that a person's spirit lives on. And I felt so sad, Jim, that all these years I've denied his spirit because I couldn't bear to think of him. Like I'd stifled his spirit. Let it fester. And for some reason, this day, I was open to it. I let it in. All the memories. All the power. And there he was. My little boy. With all his confusion and oddness and frailty. I could smell his scalpy hair smell. See the way he used to sit with his knees together and his toes pointed in. I could feel the tension around him. It was always there, like a force field. I heard his voice, that flat monotone he used to speak in, and I remembered, vividly, the day before he died. I was in his room, and he was sitting on his bed with his back against the wall, his knees up, picking at some dry skin on the heel of his hand. He had a watch, a big chunky plastic thing that had buttons on it. He had a sweatband on the other wrist, a bit grubby. I was hoovering. Ha! Imagine that, having floor to hoover. And he just watched me, through his fringe, with those dull blue eyes. I remember wondering if he would ever find anyone to love him the way I did. If there was anything there for another person to see and to want. Isn't that awful? Never came close to feeling anything like that for the others. I just knew they had qualities that other people would want. But not him. Not Reese. Oh, God, it was wonderful. Like he was alive. And dreadful. I hadn't loved him properly. And then it was gone. Like a popped bubble. And I started to think, serious for the first time, about what happened later. What happened that evening. Oh, Jim, I almost threw up, you know. Literally, my food came up my throat. So I stopped the thoughts. But I'm going to go back into his room later. Or maybe tomorrow. I'm going to go in and see if I can bring it back. What happened. Properly. Not just the aborted moment I've been playing over and over in my head all these years like a disembodied bar of music. I need to remember the whole thing, every moment. And if I can do that, Jim, I'm going to tell you all about it. Because I want you to know. And this is it, I suppose. This is the kernel of the thing. The piece of grit that got stuck inside me and turned everything else into what it is. And as you know, Jim, it ain't no pearl. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for being here, for listening, for wanting to know. I don't know what I'd do without you, my love. I truly don't. Kiss, 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 April 2011.
Molly and Megan were still in the expensive boutique hotel. Megan was no longer thinking about the tariff. She could not imagine settling it without passing out or laughing maniacally until she fell over. But there was absolutely no imminent possibility of moving into Mum's house. They were on day 4. The kitchen was empty. They had celebrated by cooking a meal and sitting together at the table. The kitchen had not exactly sparkled and gleamed. There were dust balls in the drawers, shelves hanging off the walls, stains on the pine table, and the flagstones were almost black with entrenched dirt. But still, there it was. A kitchen. An arger. A roast chicken and steamed broccoli. Microwave chocolate pudding. Wine, beer, candlelight. The uncovering of the yellow walls had been momentous, revealing the children's gallery that had been obscured for so long. Molly had examined it in great detail, endearingly searching out pictures by her mother.
"Look, Mum! Look, you drew this when you were 5. It's so adorable!"
Colin and Megan had photographed the gallery in situ, before painstakingly unpeeling each drawing, choosing ones to keep, and recycling the rest. The wall of art had preserved the brightness of the paint beneath, and it was an atypical and welcome jolt of colour in a house that had grown grey with neglect. And now here they were, Molly and Megan, back in their hotel room, bathed and pink, in fresh pyjamas. Molly cross-legged with her hair in a turban, oscillating between texting a friend and watching I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant. Megan had just got off the phone to Bill and was about to open a book when her phone rang. It was Colin.
"Darling," he said, "Rory just found something in Mum's room. It looks like it might be her computer password. Can you try and collect her laptop tomorrow morning, on your way here?"
"What is it?" she asked.
"Just a scribbled thing, in a notepad. It says," she envisaged him, lowering his reading glasses, ABC123MBRR.
Megan, Bethan, Rory, Reese.
"Sounds likely," she replied, scribbling it down on the hotel's paper pad. "I'll drive over there first thing."
She hung up a moment later and turned to Molly. "I think we've got the password for Grandma's laptop. We'll try it out tomorrow." Molly made a circle of her mouth.
"Oh," she said, "wicked."
And then she turned back to the telly and frowned.
"Honestly," she said, "what kind of idiot has a baby's head hanging out of their vagina and still thinks they're just having a bad period?"
Rory lay back against the scorched grass. The moon hung above him, almost full. Stars glittered in constellations. It was the same moon he'd stared into in Thailand. The same stars that had bedecked the same velvety sky. Extraordinary, but starting to feel more likely by the day. He got to his feet and wandered barefoot across the warm grass. He remembered it now. He remembered home. He remembered having sex with Kaylee down there by the hammock. He remembered chasing Reese around the flagstone paths, a loaded water pistol in his hand. He remembered his mother turning cartwheels, without preamble or announcement. He remembered people, members of the cast of his childhood who'd wandered off the set, never to be seen again. Aunts and uncles and cousins, dogs, neighbours, friends. He turned back to appraise the house from this distance. It had always been so full of people, and so full of life. Tonight had been good. They'd cleared away enough of the junk in the kitchen to cook a meal. They'd sat there, the 5 of them, faces over flickering candlelight, eating, drinking, remembering how to be a family. And then, after the girls had left, Megan and Molly back to their posh hotel, Bethan to Vicky's old flat, Rory had gone up to his mother's room. He'd had a sense of needing to find something. He wasn't sure what. He had no particular question in mind, just a series of black holes needing to be filled. He'd sat in her chair, inhaled the scent of her hair on the back of it, dusty and dry, with that hint of stale spice cupboard that he always associated with her. He'd put on her enormous headphones, her cans. He'd laughed to himself.
DJ Lorelei in the house.
He'd pulled her duvet up to his chin, smelled the unwashed skin on it, dampness and the death. She'd let herself die. Was that the same as killing yourself? He didn't know. Then he'd started rifling through her things. The papers that sat on either side of her. Old newspapers. Unopened bills. Her horoscopes neatly torn out of magazines and papers. Hairpins. Velvet hair scrunchies. Bottles of dried up nail polish. Old tea bags and half-eaten packets of biscuits and rice cakes. A notepad full of lists. Names of social workers, phone numbers for the Department of Health, all the people who'd phoned her, trying to help, their numbers duly noted and then forgotten about, because she didn't want to be helped. He'd found two little parcels, wrapped in pink paper, one with his name on it, the other with Beth's. He'd put them in his pocket, saved them for tomorrow. And then he'd found a small piece of lilac paper taken from one of those paper cube towers housed in red perspex. On it was written the code ABC123MBRR. There, he'd thought. There. A key. A way in. Maybe. He walked around the garden now, from corner to corner, trying to fill his head with more and more memories. It was as if he was rebuilding his childhood, step by step. The garden had been more important to him growing up than the house. This was where it all happened. Balls and dogs and water and mud, slides and swings and wrestling and horseplay, and egg hunts, of course. He remembered each nook and cranny now. The cracks in the stone walls. The flower pots and crooks of trees. He heard the echo of the noise his wings might have made as he'd flown from home, so suddenly, so starkly, without a moment of nostalgia or regret. And then he ran his finger through the gaps in the wall, praying to the gods of all above, just one egg, just one little egg, just to know that it had all been true, that he hadn't imagined it. And there it was, a moment later, held between his thumb and his forefinger, a small pink egg. He held it triumphantly to the moon. Then he put it in his pocket with the two little parcels he'd found in his mum's drawer and the slip of paper with the password on, and headed back inside. Bethan lay on her back in Vicky's old bed, in Vicky's old room, staring at the paper shade over Vicky's old light. She'd gone straight to bed after Megan had driven her back. Sophie had some friends over. Young friends, squawking and shouting and talking over each other the way teenagers do. Sophie, eyes glazed and heavy with cider, had said, "Come in, come in!" There'd been pizza boxes everywhere, and all eyes had come to rest on Beth's bump, as though it was the last thing anyone had expected to see. As though she'd brought a baby hippo into the room with her. She'd said, "No, thank you, I'm exhausted, but have fun." "We'll try and be quiet," Sophie had said. "You don't have to," she'd replied. She turned heavily onto her side at the sound of her phone receiving a text message and squashed a cushion under her bump. It was from Megan. "Dad found a password, might be for Mum's laptop. I'll pick you up 9 a.m. and we'll go by the repair shop. Sleep tight, Bethy. Sleep tight, baby bump. Love you both. Kiss." Bethan's eyes widened, her heart filled with pleasure. Megan's love. She had missed it so much. She kissed the screen of her phone. She typed back, "Love you too. Kiss, kiss, kiss." Then she slept, deep and peaceful, for the rest of the night. The repair shop had sent Lorelei's laptop to a nephew in Tetbury. The nephew in Tetbury was not answering his phone, so Megan, Beth and Molly had to drive all the way there. The nephew opened the door of a tiny cottage in a back lane in just a towel, with a cigarette burning in his hand. He hurriedly stubbed it out when he saw Bethan's bump and went up a tiny staircase in the middle of the house to get changed. A moment later he returned, dressed and combed, with Lorelei's laptop in his hands. Megan stared greedily at it. On there was the story of Jim. On there, potentially, was the story of why her mother had died in the front seat of her car, half a mile away from her own home.
"I'm really sorry," said the nephew, whose name was Josh, "but I don't think I'm going to be able to crack this for you."
He then launched into a very technical, jargon-heavy explanation for his failure, which Megan interrupted by waving a piece of paper with the hotel's logo on the top at him and saying, "Yes, yes, thank you, but we think we found it. The password."
"Oh,"
said Josh. He plugged the laptop into the wall and opened it up. Then, with large, bitten-down fingers, he typed the password into the login page. The laptop made a pretty noise. And then, there it was. Windows. Megan smiled and brought her fist to her mouth. "Yes," she said in a loud whisper. "Yes." They whisked the laptop away from him, thanked him for his trouble, and then drove, quite fast, back to the birdhouse. Chapter 16. Wednesday, 16th of March, 2011.
Jim, I relived it. The whole thing, from beginning to end. I feel weak now. Weak and horribly sick. But I'll write it down. So it's there. Maybe for you to understand me better. Or maybe for someone to read when I'm gone. I don't mean to sound morbid, Jim, but I'm 65. I'm not well. I'm not going to last forever, am I?
So back to that day. That same day I hoovered his room, that I wondered if anyone apart from me would ever love him. The day before Easter. He hadn't come out of his room all day. That was normal. Normal for him. Normal for a lot of teenage boys, I suppose. But it was the day before Easter, and Megan was back. We were all having so much fun together down in the kitchen. We were playing a game. Trivial Pursuit, I think. And there was wine and music and teasing and, oh, all that lovely family stuff. So I went up to try and tempt him down. I took him a bowl of sticky toffee pudding. I sat next to him on the bed. He looked so sad, Jim. I said, "What's the matter, my darling boy? Why do you look so sad?" He just shrugged. He always just shrugged. He was always my favourite, you know. Not in that, "Oh, my glorious, perfect child" way. Just in that he was my baby. He'd been so small. The weight of him in my hands when they passed him to me. Like a bag of air. He was my shadow. He followed me about. He was always looking to me, for guidance, for approval, for everything, long after the others had lost interest in me. Always looking at me, watching me with those sad, empty eyes. I brought his head against my shoulder. I was a bit tipsy. He said, "Get off, you smell of wine." But he was only joking, so I tapped him on the arm and said, "Hold your breath, then. I want to hold my baby boy." He resisted at first. Struggled, in that way that children do when they think they're too old for cuddles, but still have this residual need to be held by mummy. It was obvious to me that he wanted the hug. He wanted the attention. I squeezed him hard. I felt him soften. I felt him allow it.
And then he was suddenly there. His face against my face. And I thought it was a joke, that he was trying to smell my breath. I was about to say something like, "Okay, okay, I'll get off you." But then his mouth was on top of mine, and I realized he was trying to kiss me. My God, my own son, my tiny little baby boy. His thin boy's body pressed sharp up against mine. Oh, Jim.
I pushed him off, and he fell back against the wall. He stared ahead. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. I should have said something, Jim. I know I should have. I should have found a way to talk about it. My baby. I shouldn't have just left him there. But I did. I ran from his room, as though running from a monster. I bumped into Beth coming out. I saw her look at me, then look into Reese's room. She asked me if I was okay. I think I managed to squeak that I was. We went downstairs and we finished the game. Nobody asked about Reese. Nobody wondered why I'd come down without him. Nobody noticed. I didn't see him the next day. It was Easter Day. We had guests. I wanted to talk it through with Colin, what had happened. I wanted to find the right moment. I wanted it to be right. It had to be right. And then there was Vicky, standing in my hallway with a bottle of Beaujolais, and I just thought, not yet. I can't deal with this just yet. So we drank and we laughed and I put it off. I thought, tomorrow. I'll deal with this tomorrow. When Megan's gone. When the house is quiet. And then, of course, by then, it was too fucking late. So, darling, what do you think? Was it my fault? I'm so confused, Jim. He was my favourite. And I let him down. I let him down so horribly. Drinking wine, when I could have been saving his soul. And can you see now why I might have tried to avoid thinking about this? Talking about this? Because I can. I didn't just lose a son, you see. I lost a sense of myself as a mother. And a mother was the only thing I'd ever really known how to be. Oh, Jim, write back soon. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. I need you to tell me it was okay. Please. Kiss, 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 kiss. Thursday, 17th of March, 2011. Thank you, darling. Thank you. You are so insightful, Jim. So, what is it they say? Emotionally intelligent. I can't believe I had never thought before of the parallels running through everything. The threads that connected it all together. Of course, that is why I reacted so strongly to Beth's affair with Bill. To Colin getting together with Kaylee. And yes, even the man who raped my mother touching me the way he did. It's all vaguely incestuous, isn't it? It's all just a shade away from natural. And you know something, Jim? You know something terribly, terribly sad? I never hugged my children properly again after that day. I'd give them a squeeze, you know, or an arm around a shoulder, but I'd never, ever held them properly again. I was always ready to back off. Poor Beth. I think she suffered the most. Well, my love, I'm too tired to type much more now. This blasted chest infection. The antibiotics are making no difference at all, and I honestly cannot face another trip to that awful place. surrounded by all those ghastly ill people and that woman's beefy hands all over the place.
I'll type more later, darling. But for now...